Unfortunately, they didn't give the speakers any Red Bull because I'm beginning to feel after 4 hours of talking that I'm a little bit in need of it. Or the extra... No, I'll be fine. I'll get some later. I don't need coffee right now. Before the next talk, I will, though. So I came up with the idea of giving this presentation because we actually see quite a lot of animals that present to us for cranial nerve disorders. And not all of them are related to horrible things like brain tumors. There can be some things that, if you recognize what they are things that have good outcomes. They may not need specific treatment. And I thought it'd be worth going over some of those things and as well as some of the things that perhaps are a little bit more serious. Just to remind us about cranial nerve anatomy, could somebody do me a little favor on the top of the projector? The front right-hand button, can you press it twice? Again. Yes. Well, that's a bit better. The cranial nerves are all emerge from, obviously, from the brain. The first two, the olfactory and optic, are actually tracts of the brain rather than true peripheral nerves. But the others all emerge then from the midbrain in the case of 3, 4, and 6, and from the medulla in the case of everything from 5, 7 caudally, and they're numbered in the order of which they enter or exit from the brain. People always get confused about which side of the body is controlled by which side of the brain. But in the case of the cranial nerves, it's very easy. The cranial nerve that controls the left side of your head comes out of the left side of your brain. It's very simple. I'm going to go through the cranial nerves in order because usually that's how I examine them, is I start from the front and work backwards. The olfactory nerve is the cranial nerve number one, and it's very difficult to test this nerve effectively. If you're going to test it, you want to test it using attractive odors like food, not using volatile compounds like ether or smelling salts, which I can't remember what they are now, but anything that is volatile actually stimulates not cranial nerve 1, but cranial nerve 5, because there are nociceptors in the nose that detect adverse stimuli, and an adverse reaction to something volatile is actually a reaction subserved by cranial nerve 5, not cranial nerve 1. It's also the case that loss of sense of smell is almost always due to nasal disease and not due to cranial nerve 1, primary cranial nerve 1 disease. About the only exception to that was some dogs with canine distemper that seemed to develop anosmia, inability to smell odors with canine distemper, but that's extremely rare. So loss of sense of smell is usually not something that we test in the exam room. The optic nerve is tested by the menaced reflex, and you always want to test both bringing your hand in from the front of the head and a little bit from the side so that you will test the temporal and the nasal optic fields. You'll often read or have people say to you that if you make a lot of air movement, that an animal will menace just because the air movement is going to stimulate the face. The next time you have a blind dog from whatever cause, you can try that. They never blink. So all the big fuss you see about getting Perspex sheets and pieces of glass to put between your hand and the dog so that you don't disturb the air, I don't think that's worthwhile. But if you do touch the dog, if you touch the eyelashes or anything, you're certainly going to get a positive response then. So it's important not to do that. But air movement is not going to make them blink. Another thing that you can do is drop a light object, a light-colored object, and a light-weighted object. And a cotton ball is ideal for that. Subtle losses in vision, you might want to do a maze test, so put some cardboard boxes or chairs or something in the exam room and let the animal negotiate through them. The other advantage of that is you can use variable lighting. You can decrease the light in the room and see if the animal's got lost vision in lower light intensities. And of course, the most important thing is a thorough evaluation of the eyes, a thorough ophthalmic exam. The most common cause of loss of vision is primary ocular disease. But there are some diseases of the optic nerve that can also cause sudden blindness. The two major ones are bilateral optic neuritis. And I mentioned this earlier on when we were talking about GME. One of the patients that presented with GME presented for acute onset of blindness, and the ophthalmologist determined that that dog probably had optic neuritis. You can see optic neuritis associated with some infectious agents as well, but acute onset bilateral optic neuritis in an adult dog is almost only due to GME. That's really the only thing that's going to cause a symmetrical lesion. The other thing is lesions at the optic chiasm, and the big one here is pituitary masses. In the lower picture here, we have an MR of a brain, and you can see the lateral ventricles on either side. We're about mid to slightly in front of the mid-cerebrum, and this gigantic, huge thing right here is a macroadenoma, and that dog also had loss of vision. It was slightly dull, but that was about it neurologically. It really had minimal neurologic signs apart from the loss of vision. And obviously in this case, the tumor was affecting the optic chiasm. So the main primary neurologic diseases in which we see acute onset blindness are optic neuritis and sometimes with pituitary lesions and lesions around the chiasm. Central blindness is blindness where there's no abnormality in the cranial nerves or in the eye, but there's an abnormality in the opposite cerebral hemisphere. We usually get blindness in one optic field, but in practical terms, that means we get blindness in one eye. It's difficult to appreciate the loss of one optic vision in one optic field. We usually appreciate it as loss of vision in one eye. The lesion is in the opposite cerebral hemisphere, and we'll see normal PLR and dazzle response. Does everybody know what I mean by a dazzle response? When you shine a bright light into the eye, animals will usually blink. That does not mean that they can see that stimulus. The dazzle response is a protective response that's mediated predominantly through the midbrain. So if you have a cerebral lesion, you can have blindness but still retain the ability to blink in response to a bright light, which obviously is potentially damaging. We also, in these animals, we're going to look for other signs of lateralized cerebral disease, such as dullness, circling, or weakness on the opposite side of the body. So hemiparesis, if we have a lesion in the right hemisphere, we're going to see blindness in the left eye and paresis on the left side of the body as well. The ocular motor nerve has two functions. This is the third cranial nerve, and all the cranial nerves, the names, common names of all the cranial nerves either tell you about their anatomy. The trigeminal nerve, trigemini means three twins, and it's a nerve that has three branches on each side of the face. The abducent nerve, the sixth nerve, abducts the eye, so it tells you about its function. So they always tell you something about either the function of the nerve or the anatomy of the nerve. And in the case of the oculomotor nerve, obviously it tells you about the function. It has two components, the somatic and the parasympathetic components. It moves the globes, and it's also responsible for pupillary constriction. We test it by testing the oculocephalic reflex. This is what's commonly known as physiological nystagmus. When we turn the dog's head from side to side, we should see a nystagmus it's a horizontal nystagmus with the first phase of the nystagmus following the direction of the head. So I always think of it as the eye stays behind as the head moves, and then the eye catches up with the rest of the head. When we're testing the oculocephalic reflex, we're also testing cranial nerve 6, which is responsible for lateral movement of the globe, and very importantly, cranial nerve 8, the vestibular cochlear nerve. I'm not really going to talk about vestibular disease in this talk because that's a whole presentation in itself. I'm going to talk about the other cranial nerves. We also want to look at position of the globe. If the globe is positioned centrally in the head, then that suggests that 6 and 3 are normal because they're the two nerves that control the movement of the, or the positioning of the globe. Testing the parasympathetic response, we're going to test the pupillary light reflex, and there are both direct and indirect responses that we should be looking at. There's always a big discussion of what's an indirect pupillary light response. I've spent a lot of time looking this up to try and get the answer, and my understanding of it is if you shine a light in the right eye and the left pupil constricts, that should be called a right indirect response. If you shine it in the left eye and the right pupil constricts, that's a left indirect response. But usually, to avoid confusion, what I will say is, I shone the light in the right eye and the left pupil constricted as well. That makes it quite clear what's going on. You have no terminological confusion. If we have a lesion of the oculomotor nerve, we're going to see an unchanging ventrolateral strabismus. This is a Labrador that belongs to an internist who did her internship with us. She's now an internist over in Tampa. The rivals. No, we're too big an area for that to be an issue. And this is her parents' dog, and they had noticed that there was a ventrolateral strabismus in the dog's right eye. It looked like a pure oculomotor nerve lesion. One of the characteristics of strabismus due to cranial nerve 6 or 3 dysfunction, as opposed to a vestibular dysfunction, is that lesions of 3 and 6 produce a nystagmus that is unchanging in any position of the head. It's always in the same direction, no matter whether you turn the dog upside down or lay it on one side or the other or lift its head up, it never changes. Strabismus due to vestibular disease can appear similar, but frequently it will change in direction when you change the dog's head position. So that's one of the things that helps you differentiate these. This dog, we did extensive diagnostics on. It looked like this was going to have a pure oculomotor nerve lesion. And it's very hard to affect the oculomotor nerve alone, but area or regions where this could happen anatomically would be lesions on the floor of the brain, so like a small meningioma that was just involving the oculomotor nerve, or some lesions, retrobulbar lesions, but usually with a retrobulbar lesion, you're going to have a more global abnormality. We did not find a cause in this dog, and the dog has maintained this position of the eye, and now this is probably 2 years after we saw the dog, and the dog's never had any other clinical signs, so it was really kind of a conundrum. Sympathetic lesions, pure sympathetic lesions of the cranial nerve 3 are, again, very unusual. But if we encountered this lesion, what we would see is the following. If we're dealing with a lesion in the right eye and we have a pure sympathetic lesion of the oculomotor nerve, then the right eye will have a mid to dilated pupil that does not respond to light when we shine a light into the eye. If we put the dog in the dark, that eye will dilate somewhat because there'll be sympathetic activation. But when we shine a light into it, nothing will happen. If our optic nerve is normal, then we'll shine a light in the right eye, no response, but we will get a response in the opposite eye because cranial nerve 2 from the right eye is intact and cranial nerve 3 to the left eye is intact. If we shine a light into the left eye, we'll see the same thing. We'll get no constriction in the abnormal eye, but we will get a normal response in the normal eye. Does that make sense? I've only seen this on a very few occasions, and I've seen it with lesions in the midbrain affecting the origin of the cranial nerve 3. There's a couple of things I want to say about menis and PLRs and how they can, or abnormalities that can be apparent but are not real. Animals that are very frightened often don't have a menis response. I think that's particularly so with cats. If you get the animal to calm down frequently, you'll get an improvement and they will have a menace response once they settle. You do see it somewhat with dogs. It's not usually such a big problem with dogs. Animals that are older will often have iris atrophy, and you can get reduction, even complete obliteration of the PLR if iris atrophy is very severe. Again, if animals are fearful and they have a lot of sympathetic activation, PLR is often not very good. The other reason that we see pupillary light reflexes decreased in a normal animal is when your light isn't bright enough. A lot of pen lights are not very bright, and you have a somewhat worried animal in often very bright lighting conditions. The ambient lighting in a veterinary clinic is usually pretty bright. And then you shine a wimpy pen light in the eye, you won't get a very good response. So the things that you can do is use a really bright light and change the batteries in the light frequently and turn down the ambient lighting. That often will help to elicit a better response. Abnormal pupillary light reflexes can also be due to primary ocular disease, and they can be associated with midbrain lesions. So in midbrain lesions, where we're mainly dealing with things like brain herniation, we usually have abnormal PLR bilaterally, but we can sometimes see it unilaterally. This is obviously a pathology specimen of an animal with a subtentorial herniation. This is the occipital lobe on each side. Here's the midbrain right here. And if you remember what the midbrain should look like, it should be shaped something like this. It's a round shape. And here you can see it's extremely compressed. And it's compressed because part of the occipital lobes have herniated under the tentorium, producing this indentation in the occipital lobes. In doing so, they've compressed the midbrain and caused death. So it's important to differentiate whether PLR is truly abnormal or whether there's an ocular reason for it. If we see an animal that's very dull and we have poor PLRs, then I'd be worried about something like midbrain damage due to brain herniation occurring. And obviously that's an emergency situation. And as I mentioned before, iris atrophy can cause a loss of PLR, and I've certainly seen animals that have no PLR at all, and our ophthalmologists tell us that that's all consistent with severe iris atrophy. And usually when you're looking at those animals, you'll see crenation of the edges of the iris around the pupil, and sometimes you can appreciate thinning of the iris itself. Lesions of the trochlear nerve, the fourth nerve, are virtually non-existent. I've only ever seen this one time, and I saw it in a cat that had an inflammatory mass that extended over the whole surface of the skull on one side and obliterated all the cranial nerves on that side. It started as an inflammatory polyp in the middle ear, and it just got bigger until it spread over the whole surface of the face on the one side. So the cat had multiple cranial nerve abnormalities on one side and none at all on the opposite side. The trochlear nerve comes out of the midbrain, as does the third nerve, and its function is to rotate the dorsal aspect of the globe medially. So in an animal with a directional pupil, like a cat or a horse, where the pupil has some directionality to it, you can see an abnormality of the trochlear nerve because you'll see a change in the orientation of the pupil. In a dog who has a round pupil, we won't be able to appreciate that until we look at the retina and we look at the orientation of the retinal blood vessels. The orientation of the tapetum is too variable for that to be helpful, but retinal blood vessels should have a definite anatomic orientation that you will see can be, the vessels will rotate laterally when you look at the fundus in these animals. But lesions of four are very rare, even in cases where you know that there's a midbrain lesion. As I say, I think I've only seen one. The abducens nerve is motor to two muscles, the lateral rectus, which pulls the eye laterally, and the retractor oculi, which retracts the globe. So we look for, when we're looking for abnormalities, we're going to observe the eye position, and if we have a lesion of six, we're going to see a medial strabismus. We look for at voluntary eye movements. Again, we'll also be looking at the functions of three and the vestibular nerve. We look at the oculocephalic reflexes and then stimulate the cornea and look for globe retraction. Lesions of cranial nerve 6, like lesions of cranial nerve 4, are pretty rare. The majority of cases where we get poor retraction of the globe, we're actually dealing with some sort of retrobulbar or primary ocular disease. Occasionally, we also can see loss of cranial nerve 5 function, which I'm going to talk about in a moment, and loss of sensation to the cornea. So lesions of 6 do occur, but they're extremely rare, and they're usually going to be associated with significant other signs of brain dysfunction that would lateralize to that side. So you don't usually see them as a solitary problem. I was just going to talk again about strabismus here. This is another unusual case. This is a greyhound that presented to us for a completely different problem, but we noticed when we examined the dog, it had a bilateral ventral strabismus, and this was tonic. It was the same in all positions of the head. The dog had no other abnormalities of its eyes. It had normal physiological nystagmus. It had no evidence of vestibular disease. And talking to the owner, they said the dog had always had this. It was born with this. We do see this also in some breeds that have that commonly have hydrocephalus. And in those animals, it's not the hydrocephalus per se. It's actually the shallowness of the orbits in many of these animals that cause abnormality in positioning of the globes. And we'll see this sometimes in animals with hydrocephalus. They call it the setting sun sign. You'll see a ventral and ventrolateral strabismus. And they do not have primary cranial nerve 3 lesions. Most strabismus is associated with vestibular disorders. And in the majority of cases, strabismus will change in position, or it may appear or disappear in different body positions. When you see that, you're definitely dealing with a vestibular disorder and not a lesion of 3 or 6. In addition, cranial nerve 3 lesions always cause a ventrolateral strabismus. Cranial nerve 6 lesions always cause a medial strabismus. So when you see any other direction of strabismus, you're dealing with some other kind of disorder. No discussion of cranial nerves would be complete without talking about the sympathetic innervation of the eye. The sympathetic innervation of the eye does not run with any individual particular cranial nerve. The nerves are distributed along with blood vessels, and so there isn't a cranial nerve per se that we're talking about in this case. As I'm sure you're all well aware, the preganglionic sympathetics emerge from the spinal cord in the T1, T2 region along with the nerves of the brachial plexus. They then travel cranially along with the vagus and the carotid up to the cranial cervical ganglion, which lies on the medial aspect of the jaw. From that point, the postganglionic sympathetics travel up and around the wall of the middle ear, and ultimately then are distributed all over the face along with the blood vessels and similarly to the eye. Sympathetic innervation dilates the pupil, it causes retraction of the third eyelid, retraction of the upper eyelid, and also innervates muscles behind the globe that tend to push the globe forward. So when we see loss of sympathetic supply, we'll see an elevation of the third eyelid because it's not being retracted. We'll see small pupil size. We'll see a smaller palpebral aperture because we've got ptosis because of drooping of the upper eyelid. And we'll also see asymmetry in the two eyes. Here's a cat with Horner syndrome, which is sympathetic denervation to the eye. And we can see all the classic signs of Horner's. We can't really appreciate enophthalmos in this case, although perhaps you can see the globe is retracted somewhat. The third eyelid is elevated, the upper eyelid is drooping, and although it's difficult to see, the pupil is smaller on this side than the normal side. There are numerous causes of Horner's syndrome. In some cases, the underlying cause is not found. In cats, we always need to think about FELV as a potential cause. Nobody knows the exact mechanism by which FELV causes Horner's syndrome, although we think it's probably infection of the sympathetic centers within the higher parts of the brain, so within the hypothalamus. We can see Horner syndrome as a result of lesions of the neck area where we get a preganglionic lesion. We can see them as a result of lesions of the lower cervical and thoracic area spinal cord. In rare circumstances, we can see the descending tract within the cervical spinal cord affected, causing Horner syndrome. I think I've seen that maybe two or three times. It's pretty rare, and you need a very severe cervical cord lesion. You'd obviously have other signs of cervical cord lesion. Poor technique in doing a jugular puncture, getting a stick that affected the vagus sympathetic. You'd have to be pretty deep to do that, but it's happened. We also see it associated with diseases of the ear, particularly the middle ear. We can see it with retrobulbar lesions. There's many, many different underlying causes, and it can be difficult to elucidate the cause. One thing that can help you, though, is try to determine, is this a pre- or a post-ganglionic lesion? Just give yourself some idea of where to look further for the underlying cause. And what can help us to determine that is looking at the response of the eye to phenylephrine. So this is just listing all the causes. Here's the same cat a few minutes later, miraculously cured. Now you can appreciate a little bit better that there is still some difference in size of the pupils in this cat. But a lot of the signs have disappeared. The third eyelid has been retracted. The upper eyelid is more open, and the pupil size is more normal than it was previously. We put 2.5% phenylephrine drops into the eye, and we got this response within 5 minutes. You may have to wait up to 20 minutes to get this response, but most cases I've found, usually within 5 minutes you see a response. Owners are thrilled. They think you've mended everything and fixed them. It's always impressive. When we see a response to phenylephrine, we know that we're dealing with post-ganglionic lesions. This response won't develop for at least 4 or 5 days after the initiation of the sympathetic denervation. Because what we're waiting, or what we're depending on when we see this response, is something called denervation supersensitivity. The normal eye will not respond to phenylephrine at this concentration. It's too weak to cause an appropriate response. When we get denervation of an end organ, which in this case is the muscle of the levator palpebrae superioris that elevates the upper eyelid, it's the muscles of the iris, the third eyelid, and so on. When we get denervation of those end organs, we get this situation called denervation supersensitivity. And there's a couple of things that happen. The receptors on those organs have no neurotransmitter being received. So they start kind of looking for it and getting extra sensitive. So you get an increase in sensitivity of the receptors. You also get more receptors produced to try to take advantage of any neurotransmitter that's around. So when we put a weak solution of phenylephrine, which is a direct and acting sympathomimetic, into the eye, then we're going to see a response where we would not see that in the normal eye, because we have increased sensitivity of the receptors and we have more of the receptors. It doesn't happen immediately. It takes time for this to happen. So we did actually have a case, a dog who'd been hit by a car that came in with Horner's syndrome within 24 hours. And we said, oh, wow, we'll find out if this dog's got a lesion up in the head area, or we need to worry about something in the neck area. And we put phenylephrine into the eyes and nothing happened. And we were trying to figure out, we determined that it probably was the neck, and we couldn't figure out why we weren't getting a response until, of course, we realized that this dog was less than 24 hours after the accident. We hadn't allowed enough time for denervation supersensitivity to occur. Cats are extremely susceptible to anything associated with the ear, and this cat was an example of this. We have seen numerous cats with Horner's syndrome developing after they've had ear cleanings. It's been shown both in cats and in people that even a puff of air on the tympanum can be enough to ultimately produce Horner's syndrome. So our advice and the advice of the dermatologist is to stay away from cleaning cats' ears, even if they're full of wax, unless the cats have severe clinical signs where you really have to do it, something, because we've seen this with numerous cats, and this condition is usually permanent. You can, in those animals, try using a low dose of a steroid. It's probably inflammation and irritation of the nerve, and using steroids for a couple of weeks may help these animals, but others of these animals have permanent lesions, and clients end up being not too happy about it. The trigeminal nerve is sensory to the face, including the inside of the nose, at least the cranial part of the inside of the nose, the inside of the mouth. It does not subserve taste, but all the physical sensations of pain, pressure, and so on in the mouth are all subserved by cranial nerve 5. It's also sensory to the cornea and around the ear. The inside of the pinna is actually innervated, has sensory innervation from the facial nerve, and once you get down into the external ear canal, that's actually the vagus nerve that is sensory to the external ear canal. It's also motor to the muscles of mastication. Only the mandibular branch, as you remember, there's three branches, ophthalmic, maxillary, and mandibular. Only the mandibular branch is motor to the muscles of mastication. And the origins of the sensory and motor components of cranial nerve 5 in the brain are quite separate. The sensory component enters the brain at the cranial part of the medulla. The motor component comes out of the midbrain. And the two branches run together only for a very short distance. So most of the trigeminal lesions we see will be either sensory or motor and not usually both. We test the sensation in the face and also look at jaw strength. I usually have one of the interns put their hands in the mouth of the Rottweiler to test jaw strength. Motor paralysis of 5 can look very dramatic. It can look very worrying. It can also look very much like the early stages of rabies. So for this disease, one differential that you must remember is rabies. These animals present with a dropped jaw. They can't close the mouth. They have normal function of the tongue. They have normal sensation. Frequently, this is misdiagnosed as masticatory myositis. those animals can't open the jaw. They have no difficulty closing the jaw. These animals don't have any mechanical disorders, so you might have to differentiate this from TMJ disease, for example, or fractures, tumors of the around the mandible, and so on. I've seen many cases of this. I've taken many pictures to illustrate it, and they all look like the dog's got its mouth open, panting. They never look very impressive. These dogs, the onset of signs is acute. They have difficulty eating because they can't form a bolus very well. They can't get the food into the mouth very well. This is an idiopathic condition. It's thought to be a neuritis. It's probably inflammatory disease. They usually do very well. They usually recover within about 6 weeks. And the way to manage them is to facilitate their eating and drinking. The easiest way to do that is to get a muzzle that's a couple of sizes too big for the dog that helps the jaw approximate somewhat. Once you do that, you'll find they'll be able to eat and drink. People have also suggested using like a light elastic band around the muzzle for the same reason. These dogs can open the jaw okay, they just can't close it. I've always used a couple of sizes too large, one of those nylon muzzles, and these dogs usually do great. There's no known indication for corticosteroids. And you do also sometimes see in these dogs Horner syndrome. Horner's has been associated with this disease a few times. So if you see this and Horner's, you don't necessarily have to go hunting for a separate, different disease. We don't know what the association is between the two, but it may be some inflammation associated. If there's a traumatic injury or something, maybe that's what's going on. The big thing to know about this is a bilateral disease. There has to be involvement of both of the branches of the trigeminal nerve in order for this to happen. If you just have a unilateral disease, for example, if you have a trauma or a tumor, then generally speaking, you're not going to see this. It's when you have bilateral involvement. And here, as an example, is masticatory myositis. This dog, you can probably appreciate here, has atrophy of the temporalis and the masseter muscles, making the zygomatic arch very prominent. And this is as far as this dog can open its mouth. Masticatory myositis can be treated, as I'm sure you know, with corticosteroids and other immunosuppressives. But it is a serious disease, and we do see animals that run into problems with nutrition because the disease has progressed to the extent they just can't get their mouth open. So the big thing about this is to recognize it and treat them early before they get to this condition, and then the dogs usually do fairly well. And never, ever force the jaws open. You're going to cause trauma and additional fibrosis and worsening of the condition. Sensory deficits of 5 are relatively uncommon. More usually what we'll see is an animal that is either generally unwell and has decreased mental awareness because it's sick, and also lesions in the opposite cerebral hemisphere. The information from cranial nerve 5 is ultimately recognized in the opposite cerebral hemisphere. So lesions in the right cerebral hemisphere will cause an apparent loss of sensation in the left side of the face. They will, in fact, cause a loss of sensation or a loss of awareness of sensation on the whole left side of the body. But it's just a lot more obvious in the face, and so we tend to recognize it as decreased sensation on one side of the face. So if you have an animal that all the other signs fit with cerebral disease, and it seems to have a cranial nerve 5 lesion on the opposite side, don't be fooled. It's probably all due to the cerebral disease. A relatively uncommon condition, at least we don't recognize it very often, is something called trigeminal neuralgia. It's an inflammatory condition, we believe, of the sensory branches of the trigeminal nerve. And in people, it has the name tic douloureux. Tic means spasmodic, and douloureux obviously means something that makes you unhappy. And it's been described as the worst pain known to man. I think that depends on who's the, what kind of pain you have at the time. But I've seen several cases, and they have been described in the literature, where we make a presumptive diagnosis of this disorder. What we see in these animals is sensitivity on one side of the face with no other explanation. Thorough examination, CTs, MRIs, don't reveal any other cause, no lesions in the mouth or anything like that. Animals that I've seen with this condition are extremely sensitive on one side of the face and may actually become aggressive if they're approached or touched on that side of the face, because touching seems to make it a lot worse. They have a very poor response to standard analgesics, including narcotics. They don't respond to anti-inflammatories, such as corticosteroids, but they will respond to some of the drugs used to treat neuropathic pain, and the one that I've used in these dogs is gabapentin. I've used this with quite a lot of success. I've seen three cases that come to mind. One was a little terrier mix, and two others were poodles, standard poodles. All of the dogs responded to gabapentin at a relatively low dose, and in all cases, I tried to wean them off the drug after a few months to see if this situation had resolved. All of them, the clinical signs came back, and they stayed on gabapentin their whole lives. But while they were on it, they were fine. They didn't have any problems. But relatively uncommon, but something to think about. Another unusual disease, but one, unfortunately, that tends to carry a bad prognosis, is cavernous sinus syndrome. The cavernous sinus lies on the floor of the cranial vault, and through this area runs a bunch of cranial nerves, including 3, 4 branches of the cranial nerve 5, cranial nerve 6, and also the internal carotid artery. What we see clinically is animals that have lesions of 3, 4, 6, they'll have both what's called internal and external ophthalmoplegia. When you see that, that's the first thing that should key you into the possibility of cavernous sinus syndrome. These animals have no pupillary light responses on the affected side, and they have no oculocephalic reflexes. This can be a unilateral or a bilateral disease. Other signs that you'll see is loss of sensation in the cornea and around the eye, and evidence of Horner syndrome in some of these cases, because the sympathetic nerve 2 runs through this area. The primary differential as to etiology is neoplasia, and this is an oligodendrocytoma oligodendroglioma that was growing here. We can see frontal sinus here. This is olfactory lobe region, and this huge tumor was growing in that area and produced cavernous sinus syndrome. Other possibilities, particularly in people, are traumas, vascular anomalies, or inflammatory diseases. I will say that all the cases that I've seen of cavernous sinus syndrome, we've been dealing with neoplasia in all of those cases. And unfortunately, we're usually dealing with a poor prognosis. These are difficult to treat. It's in an area where surgery can be a problem because of the vascular structures in that area to try to remove this. We can disrupt the blood-brain supply. Radiation therapy would certainly be a possibility, but unfortunately most of these animals have a fairly poor prognosis because of the underlying disease. Another big disorder that I'm going to talk about is facial nerve paralysis. Facial nerve is motor to the muscles of facial expression. It provides taste from the rostral two-thirds of the tongue. It's sensory to the inside of the pinna. And it also is responsible for the parasympathetic innervation of the lacrimal glands and some of the salivary glands. Facial paralysis is usually unilateral, and we see a loss of loss of movement, but not of sensation, on one side of the face. I'm trying to get my mouse to cooperate here because I have a little video, which unfortunately doesn't seem to be doing so. What the video illustrated was that in this border collie, the dog had normal responses, blinking, moving the lips to touching on the left side of the face. But when we went to touch the right side of the face, the dog was extremely sensitive. It moved its head away, but couldn't move the face at all. Facial paralysis can be idiopathic. That's the most common cause. It also can be associated with middle ear disease. It can be associated with facial trauma, although it's more common in horses where the nerve is more superficial. Lesions of the medulla, where we'd be looking for other signs like vestibular signs or long tract paresis and so on. It's also been associated with hypothyroidism. And the explanation that's given for cranial nerve abnormalities with hypothyroidism is that we get swelling of the connective tissues around the exit foramina for the cranial nerves, and that that swollen tissue puts pressure on those nerves. Not only the facial nerve, we can see multiple other cranial nerves involved. And any time you see an animal that has cranial nerve involvement on opposite sides of the face, if it has trigeminal or oculomotor on one side and facial on the other side, definitely look for hypothyroidism in that dog. That's where I've seen that situation most commonly. One would expect, because it's an endocrine disease, that you'd get symmetrical signs, but in fact you frequently get very asymmetrical signs. The prognosis after treatment of hypothyroidism is still very guarded. Many of the neurological signs associated with hypothyroidism don't seem to respond very well to oral supplementation. Idiopathic facial paralysis, though, is the most common cause of facial paralysis. We see it in all kinds of breeds, but the Cocker Spaniel and perhaps the Golden Retriever are predisposed. This is an acute onset disorder. There's no obvious underlying cause, and these animals start to improve with time. Most of these animals will develop signs in the other side of the face as the first side is resolving. Usually a few months later, they'll get signs on the opposite side. I have seen several cases that have also had vestibular signs for which no cause could be found. So idiopathic vestibular disease, in a minority of cases, does seem to be associated with facial paralysis. There's been no proven effect of corticosteroids in this disorder, although in Bell's palsy, which is a similar condition in people, corticosteroids have been shown to help some people. This is an example of 7 and 8 paralysis, and here we can see the classic signs of 7 paralysis, drooping of the face on this side, drooping of the ear, and the dog also has a head tilt. This dog was worked up for lesions affecting both 7 and 8, either peripheral nerve lesions or lesions in the medulla. There was no abnormality, and both of these conditions resolved with time in this dog. We often see animals with facial paralysis that are diagnosed as having middle ear disease because the facial nerve can be associated or is closely anatomically associated with the middle ear. But when you see no evidence of external ear disease, a normal tympanum, it's extremely unlikely that these animals have middle ear disease. We'd expect to see something like a bulging tympanum or a ruptured tympanum, in this case with purulent exudate. I have seen one case in a Doberman that had a completely normal external ear. Bilaterally, the tympanum appeared normal, and the dog had bilateral otitis media that we diagnosed on CT. We could see that there was material in the middle ear, and the dog was treated, and the signs of, in that case, vestibular disease resolved. Here's an example of a cat with otitis media, and you can see on this CT scan that there's debris in the tympanic bulla on one side and perfectly normal on the other side. When we're looking at middle ear disease, either with respect to cranial nerve 7, but more importantly with respect to vestibular disease, we now do, even if we see a normal CT, we'll usually do myringotomy. And if we have a normal myringotomy, we will still do a CT because we've seen situations where one of the tests is perfectly normal, but then we'll see abnormalities on the other. So we tend to do both together. And here's an example of what you typically see preceding the otitis media. When you see, this is an example in this dog of both cranial nerve 5 and 7 paralysis. We've got drooping of the face on this side. We've got loss of temporalis muscle on this side. 5 and 7 both emerge from the brain at about the same site on the medulla. And in this case, we're looking at a medullary lesion. I've just got a couple more slides to go through. Here's an example of what we might see with if we see a 5 and 7 nerve lesion. Those nerves don't run together very closely except in the medulla, but when we have an extensive, in this case, chondrosarcoma, we might get both of them involved. I think at that point, because we've run out of time, I've talked about the most important lesions and those that are important to differentiate idiopathic disease and acquired organic disease that has a very different prognosis. We'll leave things at that. I'd be happy to entertain any questions. Well, thank you very much.